We want to take a little bit of time this morning and begin to pull it all together, but then spend a good chunk of time kind of feet up on the table and talking in terms of where this series or any part of it has pressed you or raised questions for you, and the insights that maybe have been jolted loose for you, or even responses and comments about the video that many of us saw last night. But I'd like to begin this morning by reading a few short poems to you. This first one's from Maya Angelou, and it's called Request. If this country is a bastard, will the low-down mother user who ran off and left the woman moaning in her green delivery please come back and claim his love child? Give a legal name to beg from for the first time of its life. Do you like that? This is Langston Hughes. This one's called Freedom. Freedom will not come today, this year, nor ever through compromise and fear. I have as much right as the other fellow has to stand on my 2 feet and own the land. I tire so of hearing people say, let things take their course. Tomorrow is another day. I do not need my freedom when I'm dead. I cannot live on tomorrow's bread. Freedom is a strong seed planted in a great need. I live here too. I want freedom just as you. Question and answer. Durban, Birmingham, Cape Town, Atlanta, Johannesburg, Watts, the earth around struggling, fighting, dying. For what? A world to gain. Groping, hoping, waiting. For what? A world to gain. Dreams kicked asunder. Why not go under? There's a world to gain. But suppose I don't want it? Why take it? To remake it. This is called history. The past has been a mint of blood and sorrow. That must not be true of tomorrow. Langston wrote one that I could not find in the library here that I wanted to share with you that you may know. It's called Let America Be America. Have you heard that? Well, when you get the chance, grab a book of Langston Hughes's poetry and find that one. Now from a poet friend from the other side of the Atlantic who spent some time on this side, D.H. Lawrence. This is titled Song of a Man Who Has Come Through. I suspect Lawrence being the kind of person that he was, if he had written that in this year, he would have titled it Song of a Woman Who Has Come Through, or perhaps Song of Someone Who's Come Through. Not I, not I, but the wind that blows through me. A fine wind is blowing the new dimension of time. If only I let it bear me, carry me. If only it carry me. If only I am sensitive, subtle. Oh, delicate, a winged gift. If only, most lovely of all, I yield myself and am borrowed by the fine, fine wind that takes its course through the chaos of the world, like a fine and exquisite chisel, a wedge blade inserted. If only I am keen and hard, like the sheer tip of a wedge driven by invisible blows, the rock will split, and we shall come at the wonder. We shall find the Hesperides. Oh, for the wonder that bubbles into my soul, I would be a good fountain, a good wellhead, would blur no whisper, spoil no expression. What is the knocking? What is the knocking at the door in the night? Is it somebody wants to do us harm? No, no. It's the three strange angels. Admit them. Admit them. Do you like D.H. Lawrence? Well, what is the knocking at our door in the night in 1992? Let me back up and pull together a few images for you. Those of you who were around last week remember that we began our work by talking about racism not as an individual experience only, and not simply as a matter of personal prejudice, but we talked about it as a socio-spirit force, and suggested that racism, as Jane Elliott was suggesting in that little video, is a devious, evil, social, institutionalized reality in our society, and that it involves prejudice, certainly. It involves discrimination, that is, public actions that exclude people from equitable participation in this society. But then far beyond those two, it includes power. And of course, we in our position of white privilege are often even unreflective and unaware of the power we take for granted. But even beyond the institutionalized dimension of racism, there is another shadow side that's perhaps even more devious and harder to get a grip on. And it has to do with a deep mythology, a deep story about humanness, which is ours as a consequence of many, many struggles over many hundreds of years, not the least of which has to do with our story, which glorifies the experience of European conquest in the New World. You remember, if you attended any of Esther's Bible studies, that one of the things very intriguing was that it got really clear to the group that whether you're talking about genocide or the glorious acts of Yahweh in history, depended a bit on where you stood. That one person's genocide was another person's Yahweh's victorious acts. And the same is true of the conquest of the Americas. You remember the old American story of Manifest Destiny? Very much like the old Hebraic notion of God is on our side. And of course, our story of Manifest Destiny and the conquest of a new land and the victory of sweat and energy and creativity at the same time was genocide. And we all participated and live off the fruits of the African-American Holocaust. And if you've not read up on your history, read about the Middle Passage and the 20 million souls who perished between here and Africa. Mm-hmm. And then read about the tribes in North America and other parts of the Americas who literally disappeared, who literally were wiped out. And those who are with us today are the survivors of the Holocaust. And if you've known any survivors of the European Holocaust personally, well, you know that there's trauma there, and there's a scar there that'll never go away. The survivors of Holocaust bear upon their being the scars of the Holocaust. But there's not only an underlying story or mythology about racial identity and finally racial superiority. There are also the little social rituals that continue to reinforce that And then even more powerfully, there are the symbols that freight that story and keep it alive. And I call that the shadow side of racism. Now, we really presume that in dealing this week, then, with our series that we've called Beyond Racism Toward a New Practical Vision of Community. And we began by talking about identity and diversity and suggested to you that the image of the yin and the yang was a way of beginning to grasp in our experience the importance of otherness or the importance of diversity, and suggested to you at the beginning of the week, for example, that the way that I grasp as I become a human what it means for me to be male is in association with female, because female is other in my experience. And the way that I grasp what it means to be a middle-aged man is to be in association with youth. That is, my identity really depends a great deal, not just on being with people like myself, but being in the presence of people who are other than myself. If you want to know what it means to be a European American profoundly in 1992, put yourself in the presence of people of color, and you will begin to understand in deep, deep ways what your identity is as a European American. Now, one of the dimensions that Nadine mentioned last night, or just whenever it was yesterday, of the whole dynamic of otherness, she pointed out that unity is in diversity. It's the unity of opposites. It's a tensional unity that is maintained and balanced by effort. And one of the things she suggested was that honor was the key value there. I want you to do a little exercise. I spent a little bit of time in Japan several years ago and in Nigeria, and in both places was just dumbfounded, struck by the deep sense of honor that's present in those cultures. And both of them use the bow to symbolize honor. And in Japan, the deeper the bow is, well, the more you're honoring the other person and the more honorable the other person is. And it was just a tremendous privilege and gift to have a Japanese person bow to you like this. I want you to stand up and I want you to bow to the person on each side of you. Now, do it now. And you decide how deep you're going to bow. Someone pointed out to me that, of course, in more ancient times than these, that when you bowed, you exposed your neck. And one of the interesting things about the dynamic of honoring the other is that it means that you're not requiring the other to be like you. That is, you are honoring the other as other. That's what this metaphor suggests in terms of human relationships. If we require the other to be like ourselves, we disrupt the balance, and the unity no longer exists.
So you did not bow back when they bowed to you in Japan?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. And it's really, really interesting, when I was in Nigeria, I even saw several times young men in their 20s get down and literally do a push-up in front of an elder as a sign of real, and one of the deep honor gestures in Yoruba land was to touch your ankle.
So they would have really expected you to bow back then. You said you didn't have to be reciprocated.
Well, you didn't reciprocate. In Japan, reciprocity means something a little differently than in Nigeria. In Nigeria, you have to sort of sense what kind of reciprocation is appropriate in the setting. Usually elders would simply just receive the honoring of another. But my point is that honor means that you don't require the other to become like you, that you are honoring the other as other. And you see, that has not been our experience in this continent. We have required people of color to put on white face in order to make it. And I guess what we're saying is that the knocking on the door in the night these days is requiring something new of us in order that we participate in the new chapter of history that's unfolding. Yes, John.
One of the things about that, though, is Japan's a very stratified society, and certainly a foreigner has a very low status in that society. You know, and so
well, true, but we're not talking about Japan now. You see my point. My point
well,
was
but I mean, but the bowing and the honoring takes place within a very class-ridden, stratified society.
That's right. But again, you see the point that I'm making with honor. I'm not talking about Japan.
Yeah.
I use that simply as a reference point. Now, the context in which I was in Japan, I was honored. And that was, knowing what you were just saying about the way foreigners are regarded, I regarded that as especially a double honor, since I was honored in that context. I was there as a teacher.
Jim?
Yes?
Would a man bow to a woman in Japan?
Yes.
They do.
Yes, but again, it depends a lot on what the situation recalls.
And
I don't want to get off on Japan, because
no,
my only point was to suggest to you that honor is part of what's involved in this metaphor. And therefore, it's part of what the new diversity requires of us, and that it makes special claims on us as European Americans, mm-hmm. because it's difficult for us to allow others to be other. Mm-hmm. It requires change on our part, and a certain difficult change. Yes?
This is kind of, well, I'll just say it. I remember reading that in the Americas, why you shook hands with another person was to let that person know that you didn't have a weapon.
So
that, even from the start,
very interesting.
It was kind of a beginning
yes.
of distrust. You know,
uh-huh.
that.
Yes, very, very interesting. That's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, yes.
Did you just say it is difficult for us to allow others to be other?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, because if it's all right for others to be different than us as long as they are out of our lives, like on a reservation where they don't bother us. But if they're going to be in the midst of our lives, in our congregation, in our workplace, in our family, in our schools, we jolly well want them to behave like us. That's all I mean. Now, then we have wanted to suggest then that, well, the video last night, if you had a chance, how many of you saw the video last night? And then, of course, the little snippet that we saw the other day was dramatizing powerfully the whole business of stereotypes and images or perceptions that we live out of, and the messages that reinforce those. And recall how Jane Elliott remarked, both in relation to children and adults, that it took about 15 minutes, in effect, to brainwash people, to program people to live down to your expectations. And she used that as a way of dramatizing for those white people who were there the power and the effect of living your whole life in a society that sends you messages that if you are not European, if you are not white, you are less than human. And those messages even get very, very subtle.
What
yes.
did you think about, what was your opinion about the people who couldn't handle it and walked out?
Yeah, well, she said it rather directly, didn't she? They couldn't handle it.
They couldn't handle it.
Yes,
yeah.
What did you think?
I don't know, I'm still mulling it over.
Yeah. And you
I
could under.
I would have been one of them. I know that I would have buckled under. Yeah. But is that good or is it bad? I don't know.
Well, maybe it's neither. Maybe good or bad isn't really the issue. But I could sympathize with the mentality out of which they were coming. It's the old American business of stand up for your rights.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's going to treat me like that. But yet the lesson she was teaching was that while that has been our story, we have required something different of whole
yes.
other groups of
yes.
people. And so she really turned the tables, didn't she?
But even
yes.
that strong reaction when they came there for a workshop.
Yes.
I mean, they were there with the idea that they were going to learn. So it was a very strong reaction, I thought, that mm-hmm. that you know, that was out of place.
Uh-huh. Yes, maybe so. Yes?
That has its counterparts, though, in the African-American who refused to knuckle under and whose
yes.
behavior everybody regards as why, what it
yeah.
wrote.
Yes.
But it's real and it's, in a sense, there's some integrity
yes.
to it.
Yes, indeed. And as she pointed out, people paid with their lives mm-hmm. for such acts of defiance. Mm-hmm. And she even suggested that we have learned such acts of defiance and the strategies of defiance from African Americans and others. But we've not had to pay the price.
I didn't catch it in the film. Did that woman come back for the reunion?
I don't
that
know.
That would have been interesting.
I don't
know.
Oh,
explain a little bit
one,
those of us who didn't see
point.
It. The woman who walked out? Or is
the woman who walked
out.
Yes.
Was
he was wondering if she came back.
The woman that sat there and said, I'm going to prove a point. I'm here to make a point.
And then finally left.
Mm-hmm. See, I missed it, so I'm just saying,
was she
contradicting the others? I mean,
she was there to make a point.
She wouldn't knuckle under to Jane Elliott's heavy-handedness.
Okay, she wouldn't knuckle under.
And
okay.
so she
it's
left, and the question was, did she come back for the reunion? And the reunion was part of the last part of the video.
She was not.
Let me go on and share some more suggestions or observations with you relative to what this kind of an image means for a new time. I think that it means for us, as European Americans, that there are new kinds of challenges in relation to working with people of color. Nadine suggested yesterday that this image suggests partnership and collegiality. And we were talking the other day about what we would mean by a term like collegiality as opposed to friendship. And we finally decided that what we meant by collegiality was relationship grounded in common mission. Relationship grounded in common work, flowing out of partnership. Now, one of the hard things to say to you and I these days is that acceptance, personal acceptance by people of color is irrelevant and is not the issue. And I say that, and I think that we need to hear that said to ourselves very strongly again and again, because our tendency is to expend a great deal of psychic energy wanting to be accepted, wanting our friends who are persons of color to say to us, I understand and I appreciate you and welcome aboard. That is irrelevant. And if that is what we are seeking, it will never come. Rather, what is possible for us now is collegiality and partnership. And that has to do with resolve to action. If we want persons of color to have a new way of viewing European Americans, well, do you know the old religious term penance? Do you know what that had to do with? It didn't have to do with feeling bad about something. It was very objective. It had to do with dramatizing repentance. There is some difficult repentance that we've got to do, and my suggestion is that where that needs to take place is in the social arenas of our society. We need to change, and we need to change this society. Joseph Bart, in his little book, and if you've not got it or read it, I recommend it highly. Joseph Bart says that there are two hard lessons that white people have to learn if they're going to sit around the table and create the agenda for tomorrow. And one of those lessons is following the leadership of people of color. Now, in some of our communities, that's not practical right now. Some of our communities don't have people of color. Well, that's fine. But there are situations and times where we will need to follow the leadership of people of color. And then secondly, the temptation is, once you decide that people of color are going to take, going to take the lead, then the temptation is to step outside of that partnership and say, all right, go right ahead. Well, we've got to avoid that temptation and say, we are going to follow. That is, we are going to remain in partnership with you. And do you understand that temptation? You don't understand that. Well, my gosh, people who have experienced the place of privilege for so many years, the decision that somebody else is going to press ahead and take the leadership, that is a hard act to follow. And it's much easier to stand aside and say, all right, go to it. Now, in the workplace, for example, I become aware that as a white person, it's much easier to depend on people of color to point out the places where racism's happening and to lead the response. Well, that's fine, except these days it's important for us to decide that we will not wait for anyone else in relation to pointing out the instances of racism that need to stop. But then in terms of putting together the strategies to deal with them, we are not in the best position to understand what needs to happen because we have something at stake personally. Even if we are not aware of it, we have something at stake personally, and it is this way society is put together. Yes?
I have a problem with that because it seems to me that that's sort of an automatic knee-jerk reaction to things, and almost always it leads to people on both ends. One who just simply takes off with with no real backing from anybody else, and then people who just fall in line and say, you know, whatever you want, I'm behind you. And I think that I understand some of the basis behind this, but I think that that kind of automatic, you know, whatever I decide, you do, I find that very hard to agree with.
Okay, well, then I think you need to cogitate with your problem and just simply work it out. The image of partnership is not that you automatically follow and do what anybody says. It's that you work out together what needs to be done. Mm-hmm.
But that's not what you're saying.
By golly, somebody's got to be out front publicly.
Oh, well, yeah,
that ain't going to be us. And if we think that it needs to be us, we don't understand the historical moment.
No, that's...
There's a kind of arrogance in us that operates unreflectively that allows us to be put in situations that if we thought about, we wouldn't. And that's all I'm saying.
Okay.
And so I say to you that, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but we'll leave it with you to brood about. Yes?
Isn't that why Jesse Jackson will never be elected president?
Yes, indeed. Yes,
well,
indeed.
We'll continue to say, well, he's never been elected anything. Well, he'll never be elected anything.
That's right.
But this will work for him to be elected anything.
That's right.
And so it's a vicious cycle.
That's right. And if you think back to 1988, who forced the candidates in the presidential election to deal with the issues rather than partisan ideology? Jesse Jackson did.
That's a very good example to help us understand that what I hear part of your comment being is the strategy and being willing to come to the table to face the facts and deal with the issues. But you can't, you gotta in one sense relinquish your own agenda to hear the others. And imaginally Jesse Jackson could not leave this country because of just that very fact. We have not seen any other kind of leadership effectively with integrity from that particular person. But we have not sat down and tried to figure out how to bring about that leadership. Therefore, we don't think it's possible. So we're back in the vicious cycle.
Let me do one other little thing about the church, and then let's just have a sort of free-for-all for the remaining 20 minutes or so. I think finally we've got to talk about the church. And I'm particularly interested in the local congregation. This is not to exclude the church as institution, that is, as bureaucratic institution, but I think that it's helpful for us to focus on the congregation. And some poetry that I would recommend to you is from Walter Brueggemann, in his little book, The Prophetic Imagination. I believe that at this point in history, prophetic presence is especially important, and where it needs to happen is in the congregation. And where it needs to happen in relation to racism is in the congregation. Well, what does that mean? Last week, one of the sessions that we did was entitled Environmental Racism. And one of the awarenesses that came to us as we worked through that session, we had a group of, 50 people for that session. And we were asking ourselves, what's the connection between the environmental crisis and social justice racism issues? And as we begin brainstorming issues and thinking about underlying realities, we begin to get clear that they're intimately connected. We believe that we will not deal with the environmental crisis, save we also deal with racism. and the other challenging social issues facing this society. They are not separate. They are deeply linked. Now, who's in position to address that? Well, I don't know, I suppose in principle many realities are. But in terms of who has the memory and the history, those are the folks that are in position to address them. And it is exactly at the point of manifesting what Brueggemann calls prophetic imagination, and it has two dimensions. Prophetic consciousness struggles to bring to public expression the grief that society cannot deal with, the pain that society prefers to paper over and ignore. So the first dimension of prophetic imagination is to bring to public expression those realities about which we are in grief and cannot own up to. And that is especially pressing and white hot in relation to racism. And that does mean, I suspect, that in our congregations, we have to struggle to create awareness and help people say what is going on in our society and name the points of grief we see in our society. The second dimension of prophetic imagination, then, if this task is based on the experience of grief, then there's another dimension that has to do with hope. It's the other side of the coin, and it's bringing to public expression the hopefulness of this moment and calling upon people to become involved in envisioning a new future and envisioning new communal realities. And it, according to Brueggemann, this task is built upon the experience of amazement and praise, as this task is built upon the experience of grief. Now, we used to live in Jamaica, and right up above us, in the little village that we lived in, which was built on a mountain, so that the village was really very small, but it took about a mile between one end of it to the other, and up the hill from us, there was a Rastafarian family, and they were fairly close. And in the mornings, almost literally every morning, we knew when that family was awake, because the young man who was in his 20s, as soon as he would wake up, I can almost imagine him stretching in his bed. you could hear a tremendous shout come from their little cabin. Now, I began to understand that was a liturgy. That was a liturgy. Now, that young man was expressing the incredible sense of newness that he experienced on waking up. Oh my goodness, that's what faith is about. Amazement relative to the newness that is delivered to us. That's the prophetic task, is to call people to participate in the amazing new possibility that has been delivered to us. But both of those go together. Is to call people to express their grief over the profound disappointment and pain that is present in our society, and then to be involved in creating a hopeful picture of the future. Now, when the local congregation does that, we can impact the communities around us, and we can dare to participate in new communal realities, and we can dare to build the foundations of inclusive community and diversity without requiring that people be like us. I rather firmly believe, however, that except we live in prophetic imagination, we will not play our role in ushering in the new. And so I leave that with you as a challenge before us. And now let's talk, and I'm sorry I've taken so long, but let's just talk and see where you have comments and questions. Yes, Bill.
Well, I'm on sabbatical in order to renew the fire in my belly for causes, and I'd love to have that hope and amazement, but I have a personal thing I'd like to lay out. It's obvious that 30 years ago, some of us who were involved in the civil rights movement did not understand the depths of racism, institutional racism. And out of our 50s naivete, we really thought that we'd accomplished something. And I think we did, and we should celebrate it. It's quite obvious 30 years later, you see the same bigots back, you see the same rhetoric in government back, you see the same realities perpetuating themselves. And what you're describing, that that whole triangle, put it in theological terms, I guess you'd say, is sin. Mm. Now, doing battle against sin is an eternal struggle.
Yes.
And you don't see victories frequently. It's sort of something that's there. But what do you, putting that into the theological category of sin, grace, where do we see the hope? I mean, where will we see the victories?
Yeah.
Where will the successes?
Well,
like we were able to see in the early 60s, because there were definite advances.
Yep. Yeah, you're really asking two questions, because you asked us to speak in the theological frame, and of course to stay within that frame, ontologically speaking, the victories are daily. Sin abounds, but grace much more abounds. As to those who are trusting and have eyes to see and ears to hear, there's amazing newness that's given to us every moment. And so theologically, we don't have to require victories out there in society, because we hold on to that which we understand gives us victory every day. But then the other side of that is the sociological victories that need to happen. And it seems to me that in the arena of public policy, for example, that we are at the point in this nation where we have to make hard decisions about our children. Our children are profoundly at risk, and especially children of color. And all you have to do is look at the statistics. Even in good old Minnesota, you know, infant mortality rate for African American children makes us 27th in the nation, whereas we're number 2 in the nation in our infant mortality rate for European American children. That's one of the statistical indices of racism. And so we have to make some hard decisions about our children and require that they be carried out in public policy. And that means we've got to be willing to tell our policymakers that we elect to quit monkeying around and giving us all this horsepucky and get to it. We've got to have new... If you think about it, to pretend that our children are disposable, particularly children of color, is to place our future at risk. And it is to symbolize our lack of trust in our future as a nation.
We can always build more prisons.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it seems to me that sociologically, those are some of the victories we've got to press for. Hard decisions about children, hard decisions about health care that are going to cost us, hard decisions about economic development, and they can be done in local communities. You may have other comments on that. No, she was saying we can build more prisons.
That seems to be the one public policy we do have.
You know, you all probably have other responses to that too. What are the social victories that we can be hopeful about? Yes, sir.
Well, I don't know if any of you folks here have grown up in a really segregated society. Now, I came from St. Louis, and boy, I'll tell you, back at the 30s, you know, in the midst of the Depression, I saw the horrors of that. I had a job that took me in what we would call the inner city today, that was called the tenement district. And I can't describe the fear. I find words inadequate to describe the fear and the horror that these people were subjected to. And it actually made me a maverick in my own family, because most of the people in St. Louis were opposed to the people of color. And I don't know, to me, throughout the years, this made me interested in the antebellum South, you know, to see the history behind this. And how will that ever be changed? You see, I can enumerate that my job took me into this area, and I was looking for people for employment and so forth. I know many times I was talking to the individual that I was looking for, and he was so afraid that he refused to acknowledge who he was. And then too, I mean, the children of that generation, they have seen this. In the same way on the white side, they've seen this hard hate for this color. And they are now young people and so forth. And the only thing I can see, this is going to take generations to wipe this out. Of course, we've had laws and so forth which have eased this somewhat. But it's got a long ways to go. And the only way that I there should be something more readily than generation to generation that it would die out. Yeah. But these children that were kids when I was going out like that, they've seen what their parents endured. In the same way on the white side, they saw the anger of their parents, and today they are adults.
Yeah.
Now, that's still inbred in them. Yeah. How do you change that?
Well, we probably don't have generations, but I think the hopeful thing is that people can change. And, you know, we can move beyond that. But it means, for example, if you live in a community where an African-American person is elected mayor or chair of city council, means that you have something at stake in working to see that person succeeds in their programs.
Well, I've seen a terrific change from those days. I mean, it's hard in those days. There's been a terrific change, but it's got a long ways to go yet.
Yep.
And
other people comment on these questions and say what you think. Vernon, please.
Well, I think that you know, your answer to that question would not necessarily be the same hope that I would see as an African American. The way I see it is that oftentimes it's bad news for white America. And one of the good things that I see is our nation is crying out, because our nation's sick. You know, I mean, you got child abuse going on all over the place. You got sexual child abuse. You got women who feel bad about themselves, how they look. You know, it's endless. But in the 50s, you could pretend like it was just our problem. You know, but now in the 90s, nobody, you know, who's in their right mind can pretend that all the problems belong to one race, you know. Yeah. So in a sense, the fact that we're all in misery together is an answer, you know, to a prayer, because you know, the reality is that until it hits you as white America, it doesn't exist. So now the reality is that it's hitting you, white America. You know, you look at the people you have to vote for in office, and you know they're inadequate. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to pretend that they're not. You know, everybody knows that you're propping up a system that no longer works. And, you know, that's hope for African Americans, simply because, and more people of color in general, I think.
That's very interesting. And Brueggemann would say, in relation to the fact that now the pain is kind of spread around, that our task as the church is to strive to give public expression to that. Mm-hmm. And think of our Lutheran congregations. I don't know about all the others, but how difficult it is for us to talk about sexual issues and family abuse. And yet to pick up on that, the prophetic task is to bring that to public expression. Mm-hmm. Else we can't deal with it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about one of the terms that you use, people of color. In my classes, I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I have Eskimos, Afro-Americans, Asians, Indians, and it was quite an eye-opener to me when I first moved there because of all these different races. And when you say people of color, do you mean all those, or do you mean Afro-Americans?
For lack of a better term, we're using people of color for all the ethnic groups and cultural groups. And we're still obviously trying to figure out how to talk with one another. Mm-hmm. And people of color has been an overall term for all the ethnic and multicultural background people. Pretty soon...
Other than European-American?
Yeah, we'll figure out another term for what to use, but people of color is just something that kind of grew, and it's somewhat becoming acceptable. But yes, to Eskimos and Native Americans, Native peoples, if we have to use terms to talk about people.
Very often when you're talking, the plight of the Eskimos comes to mind. And I was just wondering.
There's a hand over here.
How did the children of all the different, the Indians and the Eskimos do not get along very well. And the Indians and the Afro-Americans do not get along. That sounds very well. That sounds like it's the Indian that the Indians have had the hardest time. I don't know. And I think up there, maybe we have less problems with the, for instance, the Vietnamese. When I listen to people here talking about, and was it? You know, somebody told about this man when she went into the store.
I did, yesterday.
Yeah, in Vietnamese.
Well, it was a Vietnamese market, and I was looking for information about the Hmong people in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And the Vietnamese person let me know that the Hmong people were not highly recognized.
In other words, he was prejudiced against the Hmong people.
Yes, within the group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's several groups that have been called Asians, but then that's not adequate either because there's so many.
In Alaska, it seems to me that we have quite a few Asians there, and they are they're really finding a place for themselves. And economically, they're such hard workers that they're really getting ahead. And there doesn't seem to me to be too much conflict between them and the other people. You asked about
from
the classes.
Mm-hmm. He's had his hand up, and then John has his hand up.
First of all, you know, it's a temptation to see how other people don't get along, and so it takes white people off the hook. Going back to the church, Gustafson makes the statement, theologian says, the prophet's duty is to call the people of God back from their idols. Now, Joe Barton, in his earlier book, also mentions that white people have a way of not realizing they're in prison, and they've wallpapered their prison cells, so it really looks very comfortable. And I think that our churches become a refuge from reality for an awful lot of people, so that they don't recognize their idols and how God is really saying, hey, come back. It's not just a screamer role that a prophet has, saying you're all wrong, and this is, but come on back. Let there be some grief and sense of regretting that the church has been so self-centered and so happy with when it's growing and doing its thing and has the big buildings and nothing wrong in itself except when they become idols. And it's at that point you aren't going to grieve, and your hope is already, you have it already. So, you know, I've got my big church, I can run there and they sing my kind of hymns, whether they're with guitars or organs.
John.
Yes.
I think, too, that you're talking about the yin-yang thing. Certainly, Yugoslavia and Russia shows us what ethnic rivalries can lead to. And when we talk about Holocaust, I think it's a tough term to exactly pin down what it means, but at least we have a country where sporadic violence occurs. We're a very violent nation, and one reason is the diversity of peoples that are trying to get along, and sometimes that doesn't work out right. But basically, when we see what's happening in other parts of the world, we have to be gratified that we can try to work things out in a way that does not lead at least to violence, but it does not generally lead to the effort by one people to completely exterminate another. That there's occasional riots where this sort of thing happens, but it's been very rare. I mean, it happens too often for us to be happy with it, but I think that our efforts now are highlighted by what's happening in some other parts of the world and saying that we have to really work on this, and we have a society where, first of all, we don't really have a good option because we don't have people segregated as much in areas as to make that possible. And secondly, our society just doesn't really work well that way. Not that everything's been solved, but that, you know, we're...
I guess I just really disagree with that. I think that we have, we don't have to go to the streets. Our education system is doing it for us. Our judicial system is doing. Our judicial system and our education system, our church, every institution we have
are doing for white America what the people are taking guns and going to the streets are doing in the countries that you're talking about. You don't have to pick up a gun, you know, to do anything to a person of color, because the judiciary system is doing it for you.
Right.
The educational system is doing it for you.
But when you're comparing what's happening in Yugoslavia, thousands of lives that are being lost.
Thousands of lives are being lost. This way, I mean, America, African Americans are 12% of the population, but we're about 80% of the prison population.
But
so, I mean, that's, you know, those are wasted lives. Now, what difference does it make? Maybe it makes a difference to some that we're not laying on the street bleeding from the head, but we're laying in prisons, wasted.
Bill?
I think we sometimes define violence too narrowly, too. I thought that in the days when the U.S. was waxing very moralistically about South Africa, that we'd forgotten our own history in terms of what we did with the native peoples we came upon. That was genocide. That was a violent method. But now we're more clever. You see, we know we can't do that. We know we can't behave like Yugoslavia. So we're going to do it a different way. But it's the same kind of violence, just like South Africa did it a different way. I mean, they had their reservations, they exercised the violence through all the various institutions, but that's still violence, because violence isn't just beating on someone or shooting at somebody. It can be a slow process of dehumanization, of control, of squeezing the life out of people, and that can be just as insidious as the eruptions of violence where you shoot 50,000 people like it is in Yugoslavia. It just takes longer.
We got another hand. Okay.
I'm wondering if it would be too much to expect that there be a joint effort of working to end racism and sexism. I mean, I see them. I know they're two different issues, and I think they seem very similar to me in some ways. And I think about just the instances of violence against women. I heard someone say if stockbrokers were being raped in the same numbers that women are, that something would be done about it. that's
the
quote that I heard.
Same thing with the breast cancer and all of that. I mean, if it was prostate cancer killing as many as breast cancer kills, there would be a lot more research done.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Does it dilute, though?
What?
Does it dilute what we should be doing as far as, I mean, there's all these things.
Powerlessness.
Yeah, what I was going to bring out that your comments have revealed is a lot of is the systemic issues that are some way they're there so strongly that we're afraid to move off of familiarity and try to do anything different. And then when anybody does, it's unpopular, or they can't get elected, or they don't have the money to appease certain group of interest. So the question I would even want us to even think about here is to see how can we get inside of these systems in terms of how these things are fostered and keep festered. What can we do about the women in leadership kind of thing? What can we do in the healthcare system to try to break ourselves from the shackles of being caught in the vicious circle?
Can I respond to that real quick,
sure,
too? And then maybe these two, and then we better pull the conversation to a close.
I
wanted to say, just in response to that, that congregations can play a key role in terms of being willing to risk who fills the pulpit. Now, there's a little town of Manson on the shore of Lake Chelan, an all-white community, probably has some Mexican-American people there, but no African-American people. And there's a African-American woman filling the pulpit of the United Methodist Church in Manson.
Yeah.
Now, she may not be a fiery prophetic preacher, I don't know. And who knows, it may be a really rocky road for that congregation. But whether that's the case or not, my goodness, what a daring step to take.
That's the main problem, is that the congregations won't even call the women to interview. That's the biggest problem.
Some of them definitely have been turned down.
Yes.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
They just
want
to interview.
Two more people with comments, please, and then we've got it. Then we can talk informally.
Well, it seems to me that Americans have always wanted, been called a generous people, but we also then want gratitude for any generous deeds we do. And it seems to me that in the area of racism or any of that thing, you can't expect gratitude. That I remember when I worked in inner city area in Columbus, Ohio, and you know, I thought I was really doing a good job, you know, and a black person took my place, and she walked in and said, "White people," she sort of looked dismissively at me and said, "White people know nothing about poverty. I'm in charge now." And I felt very hurt. And then I thought, well, that's probably the reaction that a lot of black people have gotten from a lot of white people through the years. And then the church we went to was an inner city church. And we were all, you know, very much into, well, we want to integrate this congregation. And, you know, this is going to be this great thing. We're going to have this integrated congregation. And then pretty soon there were more teenage black people than were teenage white kids. This is in the 60s. And they didn't want any white kids in the choir. And I thought it was a little reverse there. And I remember the reaction of a lot of white people, myself included, you know, I'd be hurt. You know, here we are trying to make this integrated congregation, and you know, want any of us in the choir. But then I thought, you know, why should you do what's right and expect gratitude for it? You know, I mean, but it's this feeling that you've got to do what's right, even if people say, so, big deal. Yeah. Big deal you have a black minister. So am I supposed to be grateful?
Okay, all right.
You mistaken me for someone who cares?